Session number 12394, Jim Gilbert, Reel 5.
Gilbert, Reel 5.
So the point I was making is the sheer size in terms of economic value of the military hardware manufacturers is enormous. It's an industry that competes as an oligopoly rather than in pure competition. They can do lots of things with pricing. Price fixing isn't all that difficult, so that there's plenty of excess profits to be channeled into whatever endeavors they want. And certainly the chief executive officer of a manufacturer of munitions is committed to the longevity of his firm. He is not interested, and I know there have been times in my life when I really believed that peace would be achieved in a armed truce type of a situation, that Reagan talked about peace through strength, and I thought that made a lot of sense. I no longer do, by the way.
Let me ask you now, about your changed attitude and when the sort of events leading to this in the 1980s.
I think, as I look back, for me the answer to that probably is I was married and divorced, and then I remarried a woman, a different woman, shortly thereafter. As a person, I had spent most of my life in a lot of emotional pain. And I look back at my life, and there were very few periods where I was truly happy. College was one period that I enjoyed a lot of happiness, or the lack of pain is maybe a better way of putting it. And I think, again, that we do what we do for reasons, and that there are very, very few coincidences in life. And the woman I married, it turned out, was a victim of incest and had no knowledge of that experience. And somehow in our marriage, she started to get in touch with, first, issues surrounding incest, and became a little bit interested in it and started investigating it, and then was able to start personalizing it and literally relived the trauma of the event as though it was happening in the present. And it became a really difficult relationship. There's an organization here in St. Louis that has several programs, and one is that they offer classes for men that are in relationships with women that have been sexually assaulted. So it became clear to me that the problems in our marriage were the result of this experience and the difficulty she was having. And they were offering a class, so I went and negotiated that I would attend 6 sessions for $90. So for $90, I was going to be able, and I guess 6 hours of my time, learn all the things I needed to do to be a better husband and make life better. And what I learned, it was a whole new perspective towards life. Sometimes I feel like I have a mind that's like a kaleidoscope. Things will come into focus and I'll understand it, and then I'll hear something and the kaleidoscope changes and I'm confused again. And as I look back, I started college in 1964 and I graduated in 1971. And I spent 2 years in the military and I went to night school. But I took a lot of classes. I took more than the minimum. I enjoyed learning. But it's noticeable that my transcript has no social sciences other than economics. And I avoided psychology and sociology and anthropology and anything to do with feelings. We had a requirement where I went to school. You had to take some philosophy and you had to take some social sciences. And I was able to take the philosophy of social sciences and satisfy both those requirements and not have to deal with feelings. And I've come to learn that that there was a real core reason for that, and it was that that I was not yet ready to experience my feelings, that I had so much pain that I wouldn't have been able to stand it. And as I was involved with these men in this class, and it was clearly a safe place, we're all in kind of the same boat, I started to learn that the problems in the marriage weren't really related to Edie, my wife, former wife, but rather I had a lot of power and control, and I was contributing in my own way. And I started to learn about abuse and how people abuse each other. And I learned how men can use a society's oppression almost unknowingly and intuitively to gain advantage over women and, in essence, abuse women. And I started to understand that the problems in the marriage had a lot more to do with me and what I was contributing and also how I was responding to her and her problems than they did with her. And it was like I had my whole set of issues and she had hers. And on Edie's side, she was getting counseling. And I wound up going to a particular psychotherapist for counseling. And she wasn't able to get through the pain and decided that she needed to leave and go live in California. And it's kind of, sometimes we call it the geographic cure, kind of try to run away from the problem and it doesn't work. But that's not really my problem. I became infatuated with discovery of these hidden motivations, and I became excited at learning that behaviors that I had taken on that seemed bizarre had good reasons behind them, and that I, in some ways I was protecting myself, and yet on a conscious level I was always berating myself and persecuting myself for not being how I wanted and doing these things that I didn't like and not being the fellow that I thought other people would respect. And so a lot of my life was a real hell of emotion. And I remember finishing my therapy. And the therapist, we had in a strange kind of way, had a friendship develop aside from, not that we ever saw each other in circumstances other than professionally, but there was something there that we knew we each liked each other. And so we had a little bit of an exit interview and a chat, I guess. He was remarking that when I first went to him, his policy was to interview the potential client to find out what their issues are, to be sure that he felt that he could help this person, you know, and get some background. And I remember going through that interview, and then at the end he said, "Jim, I've never done this before, but I don't feel like I'm yet able to make a decision about whether I can take you on. So I would like you, if you're willing, to come back for a second session." Well, I didn't know that was, I mean, you know, I don't know what that means at the time, because I'm new. I've avoided this like the plague, you know. I mean, anything about feelings and I'm gone. It turns out in explaining things about my life that the term he uses, it just blew him away. All of these problems, all this bad stuff happening, etc. And some of it, I don't think any of it is coincidence. You know, I'm not saying I invited it or I deserved it, but yet things progress. You know, and I am the product of my parents' lives, and they are the product of theirs. And things, it's not necessarily a grand design, but you can look back and find reasons and influences and things like that. And the implication to me is that I had a worse life than usual. Not the worst, certainly. I started to learn about the unconscious. And I used to laugh at people in college about the unconscious. I thought that was just hocus pocus, you know, just baloney. It's a way of denying our responsibility, making it somebody else's fault, just a lot of baloney. And probably, as I look back, I was probably even cruel to some people in my assessment of things. And I think it was unconsciously a way of steering the conversation to other areas and to really avoid this, because it turned out I was in tremendous pain. I had an experience that really vividly mirrored that for me. As I got better and I got into touch with certain issues, one of the turning points, I know I'm kind of rambling, but like this kind of comes back in threads. A man named Mark Robinson was in one of these groups, and I was kind of discovering some of these things. And I'd spent all my life feeling bad about myself and shameful and guilty. And the timing of this remark was providence, I think. But he said, "Jim, given the very context of your life, your seemingly abnormal behaviors were, in fact, normal." And I was able to hear that, and it was like absolve myself that while I couldn't deny my responsibility for having done things that I didn't like, at least there were influences that I could acknowledge and not ignore, and that I wasn't crazy. I wasn't abnormal. 'Cause you're talking to a guy who, if you remember, as a young child, was sent to a psychiatrist. No one ever bothered to tell me. I took the test with the ink blots and counted forwards and backwards and spent a whole half a day with this guy. And no one ever bothered to tell me what the results were. You know, it was like it was unspoken. Why did I have the courage to ask? But I was pretty clear that it couldn't have been good, or they would have told me it was good. And so I knew that there was something a little bit amok up here.
Did this sort of awareness that you were getting of yourself, you know, and the help from the psychiatrists and these other people, you know, was it altering your opinion about, for instance, war and other types of violence?
I don't think yet. I think where we were going is that I started to learn about abuse. And that as I learned about abuse, I started to see how I was had in my life abused people, and truly on a conscious level didn't know it. But then as I rethink back, I certainly was doing what I was doing to hurt them back. I was raised, and I think, I don't know if this is a global thing, but if you hurt me, my inclination is to hurt you back.
Mm-hmm. Do you sort of extrapolate this to sort of social violence?
Absolutely.
And then war?
No doubt. I see that. As a result of all of this experience, I wound up taking the training and becoming a counselor, okay? And I worked with men in groups for 6 years. And I became, again, I don't mean this in a arrogant way, but given my experiences, I was able to empathize with men who were terribly violent, had this core of rage, and were in many ways just hurt little children, and able to help them help themselves. I've had men, I remember one man, 34 years old, and he had been in my group twice, and I did an intake interview with him, and I asked him if he had been the victim of sexual abuse, and he jumped. And this guy was a really violent guy, too. He'd been a prison guard. That was his job, you know. Why did he want to be a prison guard? I mean, it's no coincidence. And he looked around, and he was scared, visibly. I mean, I could see he was shaking. And he said, "This won't go any farther, will it?" And I said, "No." and I was the third person on the planet to know about this abuse, that, and it was his brother that was the perpetrator. And all his life, the 34 years, and this happened when he was 8 to 13 in that time frame, he had this fury, this rage. He hated his brother. His mother never understood. He never told anybody. All his stuff bottled up, and when it would come out, he would break his wife's jaw twice, throw her off a porch down steps. I mean, he tore up a trailer, lived in a mobile home trailer, just in a fury of rage, just disintegrated it, just destroyed it. These are all unhealthy responses to this anger. And I learned that anger is a real healthy emotion. We should never be afraid to be angry. It's part of us. It's like being happy. You know, and I try to work with just four emotions: mad, glad, sad, scared. Because the men I deal with in this kind of an environment don't know feelings. They don't relate to feelings. And it's a marvelous process, because it just keeps, it's like an onion unpeeling, you know, it just keeps opening and opening and blossoming. I learned that, well, the essence of conflict resolution. Okay. If I want you to do something, as a man in our society, there's a lot of press. Women are oppressed. I believe, and I don't say this to be cute, I say this because I want people to think about it, that every woman in this country is sexually assaulted every day of her life. And if you look around at the media and the and how we sell beer, you know, we use bikinis, if you've watched our television, to sell beer and all these kinds of messages. Women, as far as they've come, they're still oppressed. They've got a long, long way to go. And I'm not sure that today we're not going backwards, to be honest. I think we are. Well, we have socially acceptable ways of men, when I say we, I mean men, of dealing with our women. You know, we're taught, and in movies, and what masculinity is about, we are to dominate. There's a phrase, the rule of thumb, that people know of, and it's, it goes back to the old English, that a man was not allowed to beat his woman, and it was a possessive, with a rod that was wider than his thumb. So that the law said, you know, if I beat you with something a little less than this, it's permissible. I have the right to do that. It's okay. And there's just thousands and thousands and thousands of little pieces of history and tradition and thought, and it all adds up to a society where women are in a subordinate position to men. And there's no question that that's true. What I've learned is that if I treat you with respect and with dignity, and I can break it down into a model of three elements, my feelings, my issues, and my wants, and talk to you about those three things, and you can grow to trust me that you can talk safely with me about your feelings, issues, and wants, that we can negotiate ways that we both gain. And I have seen this go beyond the dynamics of a one-on-one to groups. And in my experience, I've facilitated groups with conflicts. And the traditional ways that people are raised is we try to intimidate and dominate. And we do subtle things like name-calling to try to discredit the other person. If I interrupt the other person, it's a way of saying that I'm more important. And as long as we are operating in these manipulative and dominating kinds of arenas, the process is just real muddled. The Gulf War was a great example to me of how not to get what you want. I believe from what I've read and just for lots of reasons that April Glaspie was the ambassador of the United States to Iran. And she's admitted to having several meetings with Saddam Hussein. And she's not denied that she made the comments that the United States, and speaking on behalf of the United States, did not consider Saddam's contemplated invasion of Kuwait to be anything but an Arab matter and a border dispute, and that we would not be involving ourselves in that. And I believe that she said those things, and I believe that she was told to say those things, and I believe that the reason is that the United States has become uncomfortable with Iraq's military and possible nuclear capabilities. And given the history of the relationship of Iraq and Kuwait and Kuwait's lending of money to Iraq in the Iraq-Irani war and wanting the money back, et cetera, and some disagreements about the borders and the Ramadi oil fields, it seems to me you take all of that in context, and the United States, in essence, invited Saddam Hussein to invade Iraq, suckered him in there, and then shut the door and didn't let him out and provoked a war. If he went in and if we truly wanted him to leave, okay, we didn't need to fight a war at all. I mean, there's just no evidence that the whole pre-bombing phase consisted of one six-hour negotiation session. And in my experience, the first 6 hours, you're just trying to sort through the baggage, the hard feelings, the name-calling, to try to get to some place of commonality and try to start to develop a sense of trust. These people called each other horrible names, and I know Bush consistently dictated what had to happen to Saddam Hussein and left Saddam Hussein with no choices other than to capitulate and be seen as dominated by George Bush, or resist and maintain his integrity as a free agent and put in a box where there was no alternatives. And we refused, as I see it, to give him any outs. And it was brought up to Bush about, what about saving face? And Bush's comment is, I don't care about saving face. Well, all of this supports conflict. It does not support the resolution of a conflict. If we truly wanted Iraq out, one of the questions we probably ought to ask is, why are you in here? What is it that you're really wanting? And of the Kuwaiti people, you know, what that region has been laden with problems for centuries. And nothing is independent of all of their histories, you know, and it all is enmeshed. And it's not just Iraq, Kuwait. And if we're really going to have a peace initiative, we need to be respectful of all the people. And we need, I think, it's impossible to do this without also being respectful of the histories of all of these people, because the Palestinians were evicted from their land, just like the Catholics in Northern Ireland. You know, and I can understand Catholics 400 years later. You know, that was my land, right? My family's land, and so. But does the solution present itself? Well, we're going to send all of the Protestants back? I mean, they've been here 400 years. Is that? No. We don't have another island that's a clone that we can send everybody and everybody get back to where it would have been. So somewhere we have to say, well, okay, there have been tremendous wrongs, and we can't undo them. We can't go back and make them have not happened. What we can do is choose now how to respond to these wrongs in ways that are respectful to all of us, and try to come up with solutions that are acceptable. Fair is a notion we have to talk about throwing away, because it's a value judgment. What you think is fair can be very different than what I think is fair. And we need to not tie things to fair. We need to try to find ways that we can agree, right? And if we commit ourselves to that, we'll do it. Okay? I mean, I've seen it happen. But it's simply the commitment's got to be there. We've got to do it. But if we do, we will.
So given the fact, you know, that that's how you viewed the Gulf War, and presumably from the start, you know, what you say, you seem to be very well informed. Did you take any action against it?
Yes, I did. The invasion was August 2nd, and I knew what I read. And at the time, it seemed to me that Iraq was wrong. I thought then we virtually immediately sent 250,000 troops to Saudi Arabia. And I thought, well, you know, that's a lot of people. When I was in Europe, Vietnam, the highest troop strength was 500,000, and when I was in Europe, we had 350,000, and you got 250,000 on this border protecting Saudi Arabia, and I'm not sure that I could imagine Saddam Hussein waging war on Saudi Arabia anyway. And if he made threats to do that, it seemed like it would be more temperate to act then. But we did it. And it was defined as a defensive action. We're defending Saudi Arabia, and so I wasn't all that upset. And it seemed to fall within, I think they stretched the constitutional guidelines, but it wasn't an offensive action, so it seemed okay. Shortly thereafter, they sent another 250,000 troops. That, to me, violated my senses of justice and right and wrong, because we have a constitution that requires Congress to ratify a war, that the president cannot do that unilaterally. And the first 250,000 was more than adequate for defense. More troops can only mean an offensive position. Now, it might have been a bargaining chip to Saddam that I got more people than you've got. Okay? Another part of what was going on in the United States, though, is we were told that Saddam Hussein had an army of 400,000 people. And after the war, it appears that a couple hundred thousand of them evaporated. They never existed. Which to me was a ploy to get public support that we needed to mass 500,000 up against a force of 400,000, and that the American people would be upset of 500,000 against 200,000. And I believe that George Bush was taking absolutely no chances in losing, or looking like the appearance of losing in any way, because of the political ramifications. And I think it's really important to know that when Bush was vice president under Ronald Reagan for 8 years, he was caricaturized as a wimp, as a weak kind of a person who would do anything and kind of wishy-washy and didn't have any integrity or strength. And I think he probably didn't like that. And I think that one of the things Desert Storm and Desert Shield did was give him an opportunity to work through those issues about WIMP, unfortunately at the expense of hundreds of thousands of lives. But I think, again, we don't want to take that out of context, and we need to know that this is a man that was seen as wishy-washy and didn't like that. And I think that that has a lot of influence in why he is so tries to appear so strong and dominating and vicious and brutal. So I think the American people were lied to about the troop strength of the Iraqis. I would hope so. I would hope our intelligence network isn't that defective and incompetent. And so what George Bush did was it violated the Constitution, which is the highest law of our land. And if we don't have a Constitution, we don't have freedom. We rely on the benevolence of our rulers. And that's not where I want to be. You know, I want this Constitution to be upheld. So I challenged Congress. I went to I was asked to give a talk in front of Richard Gebhardt's office, and he's the majority leader in the House of Representatives. Majority leader. So he's powerful. And my position was, Bush does what he does. It's illegal. It's Congress's responsibility and obligation and duty to recall those troops and to not allow him to do this. But the Republican machine, I don't want to make it sound like it's all people who vote Republican, but there was a power group, and they were pumping out what, I don't know of a word to call it other than a propaganda, that if you're against this war, you're not a good American, that you're either some kind of weak something. This war is for freedom, see? And they said that. This is for freedom. That's just a lie. And Congress has to do this, but they didn't. They couldn't. It's like they are so political that they're unable to honor any moral kind of compulsion to do the right thing.
Did you get anywhere with this man, this Richard Gebhardt?
No. Then we, but I. But what it did is it put me into the anti-war movement. I then would go to rallies. See, one of the things about this war, well, let me come back to that. Every Monday from 11:30 to 1, we stood in front of the old post office. It's a government building downtown, with placards. Basically, it's a public statement that we are challenging the propriety of this war. And I took enough abuse that I wrestled with this, but I felt like